copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I begin with the concept or the assumption that there's a loss of rational discourse within, I'm going to make it broad, within the United States, within the West. I'm not saying that that's true of everybody, but if you try to converse with people, you will realize that very few want to listen to a logical argument. They just want to get the main point, give me the bottom line. Well, in speaking of the gospel, the bottom line is you must believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. But what sense does that mean if you haven't gotten before? Why do I need to do this? So a vision of reality, I suggest, does determine how we view everything. And there, every time we plan or perform an activity, in what we take to be the realistic manner, we do so by putting our confidence in a set of deeply held beliefs about the nature of reality, Paul Tyson. That is, we think reality is a certain way, and then we order our beliefs according to that. So, for example, as a Christian or as a realist, I believe there's such a thing as causal relationship. So I think that if I do one thing, it could cause another. That is, if I throw a ball at a stick and I hit the stick will fall over. That's a causal relationship. Well, that's how I think reality is created. So, consequently, I plan my life accordingly. But most of what we hear today are what might be called either misplaced arguments or only emotive attacks. I'm angry and I'm going to say this or I'm going to say that. But listen to interviews on television or on the internet and see how persuasive arguments are for one position or another. And you will be terribly disappointed, I think, because you wonder, how in the world do you think that argument supports this claim? I have a number of examples of that, but I'll forego it for today. Most of them are what we call the abusive ad hominem argument. That's a philosophical term that simply says you argue against the man and not the position. So today we have, you know, you're a rotten liberal or you're a stiff-necked conservative or whatever label you want to assign. And so that's supposed to be the argument, that if you're a Christian, you couldn't say anything real, you are living in a wah-wah land. You don't know what's really going on. So, oh, he's a Christian. You don't have to listen to him. That's abusive ad hominem argument. There are basically two forms of views of realism. Now, the point of all of this is to say, how is this affecting our sharing of the gospel? If there's a loss of rational argument, then how do we present logically, rationally, the story of the gospel, which starts all the way back in Genesis? Well, people can't follow us that time. So what are possibilities? And why they can't is often because of the vision of reality they have accepted. And so quickly, there are two that I'm concerned about in this lecture. One is what we call anti-metaphysical realism. That's a naturalistic realism. Now, this would pretty much be those who are in the scientific world. I don't mean everybody in the scientific world thinks that way, but if you were to find a large group of people who do think this way, it would probably be within the scientific community. That's not a bad thing, I'm not suggesting, but this idea is there is really a reality, but it's confined to the natural world. Now, the idea of reality is we could say the reality is independent of the mind. Now, that's what a realist would say. Even a naturalist would say, Reality is independent of my mind. But the only reality that's available to the mind is the physical world. Therefore, everything I do and think is related to the physical world. There is no such a thing as a soul, consciousness, or there's no transcendent realm where universals might exist. Edward O. Wilson, premier biologist, Harvard, who says we are approaching a new age of synthesis when all testing of consilience, that simply means coherence, is the greatest of all intellectual challenges. Philosophy, the contemplation of the unknown, is a shrinking domain. In fact, he wants to see it go away altogether. If you read the Humanist Manifesto 2000, they are saying death to the arts, death to philosophy, death to theology. Everything now must be understood in the concept of naturalistic realism. Now, what happens when this takes place is that there's a loss of a universal. That is, there's no such thing as absolute truth. There's no such thing as absolute right and wrong sort of notion. Transcendent realm, in a different view of reality, we say the transcendent realm is what orders the physical realm. But if there is no transcendent realm, well then, the physical realm is all there is, and it's on its own to order itself. Or man will do it for him. Lose the transcendent realm means that the loss of ordering the physical world, so we lose all kinds of ordering, like moral ordering, or spiritual ordering, or you could think of other forms as well. Well, when that happens, because we're all different, we end up with having warring tribes. That is, today there's a lot of talk about maybe racism, and there's talk about different forms of phobias. And so we see ourselves as individuals, and there's nothing that holds us together when you lose the universal. Because what, from a Christian perspective, what holds us together is that we're all made in the image of God. But take that out, and we're now left on our own. We are only what we do. Well, that affects society. But I don't need to go through this that a lot, because I'm just trying to establish where the problems lie with different views of reality. As Richard Weaver said in 1948, the loss of the universal means relativism. Why is it the West is just bogged down with relativism? It happened because with the loss of the universal, we denied there's anything above experience. And of course, that would put God out of the picture as well. And so the only meaning that there is now is meaning between the particulars. So when somebody loses their job, which is their only source of sense of significance, they go into great depression, of course, because they've lost their sense of significance. The anti-metaphysical realism, now these are people who deny any kind of realism. They call these folks postmodernist. There's no worldview. Objective reality is denied. There is no reality outside your mind. My reality is mind constructed. So Richard Tarnas, who wrote the book, The Passion of the Western Mind, a textbook that's been used in many of the universities in America, he says that properly speaking, therefore, there is no postmodern worldview, nor the possibility of one. Postmodern paradigm is by its nature fundamentally subversive of all paradigms, for at its core is the awareness of reality as being at once multiple, local, temporal, and without demonstrable foundation. Why? Because it's really only in your mind. Now, if your reality is in your mind, and my reality is in my mind, how in the world can I possibly try to convince you of what is in my mind? Well, it doesn't matter. Because as the lady says to me, that's good for you, dearie, but I have my own reality to live by. Do you see what kind of difficulties this is raising for us as Christians trying to present the gospel. For in this case, all truth claims have equal status. See, the postmodernist denies there's any objective reality. There is nothing outside the mind. Whereas the naturalist thinks there is a reality, but it's only physical. All truth claims, under this view, all truth claims have equal status. There's no objective reality. There's no way to judge one claim better than another. Truth is confined to the individual. Reality is and truth are all totally relative. And yet we're called to speak the gospel of Christ into this sort of an environment, an intellectual environment. Now, if you were to ask the person on the street, are you anti-metaphysical in your vision of reality? They would probably look at you and say, and what are you saying? But they have just adopted that because that's the air they breathe. So they haven't thought it through, but that's how they're trying to order their lives. And those people who held to the naturalistic reality, who says, yes, there is a reality out there, but it is only physical, and my only sense of significance is what I have, those people have come upon hard times. Because if you know anything about the minimalist movement, there are a number of people who are just saying, all of this work, all of it means nothing. I thought if I got this good job and I made this kind of money, I'd be happy. My life would be fulfilled. And all of a sudden, guess what? They've got all the money. They've got the Beamers. They've got the three-car garage. They've got their 3,000-square-foot home. And it's meaning nothing. It doesn't fill the void. So what have they done? They've gone to the minimalist movement. They've sold their big houses, and now they're living in 500-square-foot homes. Excuse me. Yes, 500-square-foot homes, which would be about half the size of this room. And now there's a whole industry that's come up because of that. That is, now they're making these appliances for these minimalistic homes. But what do you think is going to happen in 4, 5, maybe 10 years? They're all going to realize that did not solve the problem. But you see, they're trying to find, to live within their vision of reality, and they think they can find a way to do it, but you see, it's against humanity. And sooner or later, it comes upon hard times. Now, both of the visions of reality that I've spoken of, they all lead to somewhere in the same place. You actually have a form of relativism. Now, what are the consequences for apologetics? I think that, in a way, theistic arguments are beginning to lose their traction. I'm not saying we don't have theistic arguments. I think we do. I am just saying that if you're talking to the person on the street, I suspect theistic arguments don't really get a lot of traction. I'm not saying they're bad or anything like that, but their usefulness in many cases in everyday conversation are really losing their traction. Our message conflicts with both the beliefs and the sentiments of the world-nurtured earthlings. See, our vision of reality is what nurtures our sentiments. And our sentiments are the things that we begin to invest ourselves in. And so here we have people whose sentiments, things they think that are valuable, that are being shaped by the world, and they're saying there is no absolute truth, etc. And then you and I bring a message for the head that runs right in conflict with their sentiments. And so they're not interested. The need for pre-evangelism, I'm going to suggest, is practiced by both Lewis and Schaefer, and that's something that would awaken within the individual that points to something beyond the material. And I think for Christians, if I'm right on this, that I don't think we have to make an argument for this. I think all human beings are born with a sense of the transcendent. They may cover it up, they may deny it, they may have chosen something else, but I think all human beings are born with the idea of the transcendent. Allow the non-Christian to see the end of his beliefs or his presuppositions. That's what Schaeffer did quite well. In fact, Lewis uses imagination. Alistair McGrath says, Lewis's analysis of the limits of reason makes it clear that we need more than rational arguments to challenge the spirit of the age that we are now living in. If a myth is caught, it begins to work its magic of intellectual and moral transformation. So what I'm suggesting here is the possibility that maybe we can think more about not just doing apologetics with rational argument. Now, that doesn't mean they're not rational. I'm just saying the rational argument. And thinking, are there other ways that we're able to speak to the unbeliever who's had these sentiments that have been shaped by the world in which he lives, and then be able to come in with the message of Christ, but it isn't coming in a conflation way. Lewis wrote, the difficulty, he says, and this was in 1945, all right, so don't feel that you're living with something that nobody else has. The difficulty we're up against is this, he says. We can often make people attend to the Christian point of view for a half an hour or so, but the moment they've gone away from the lecture or laid down our article, they are plugged back into the world where the opposite position is taken for granted. That's so true. That's what we find ourselves dealing with today. Because the sentiment of the heart has been nurtured, has been trained to the things of this world, and they might be admiring what you have to say, but as Lewis says, put the article down, walk away, and sooner or later what takes over? The sentiments of the heart trained by the world. As long as that situation exists, Lewis says, widespread success is simply impossible. We must attack the enemy's line of communication. What we want is not more little books about Christianity, but more little books by Christians on other subjects. What a wonderful idea. Because, he says, what we do is we begin to retrain the sentiments by talking about, you know, biology, or talking about the arts, or talking about other subjects, but talking about it from a Christian vision of reality. This was a sermon that he preached. Lewis felt very, very much in line with Plato's tripartite soul, the head, which he said that's the reason, the chest, sentiments, and belly. Now, this comes out of Plato. Now, I hope that doesn't disturb you too much. How many have read Abolition of Man? Okay. So if you've read that chapter, Men Without Chest, this is precisely what Lewis is getting at. It is, in our case, Lewis is saying the difficulty of maintaining a devotion to truth in the sense of honor if the chest is cut out. Because I came to Christ in a very emotional environment, it wasn't too many months after that I just went headlong in the other direction. I thought nothing to do with emotions in my world. Christianity is all about the head. A good rational argument will knock a person down to the knees and they'll call out on Jesus. Well, it wasn't long before I realized that probably wasn't working either, because we have men, generically, we have men whose chests, the sentiments, have been shaped by the world. And we have a message that's been shaped by heaven. And there's a collision. I say maybe we're men with chests where the sentiments of the chest are crafted by the ethos of the world, which is contrary to the sentiments of Christianity. I talk a lot and done considerable writing on this matter of the ethos of the West, which is creeping into the church. It's an ethos that build sentiments, to use Lewis's line, that build the sentiments that inform the chest, that are very often not connected to the head, but simply to the ethos of culture. Now, ethos is extremely powerful. Every advertiser knows this. When you go to the mall, you must realize that everything in that mall has been designed to create the ethos of consumerism. So that you go to the mall thinking, I do not need to buy anything, I think I'll just go and look, and guess what happens? When you leave the mall, you're laden down with packages. Now, that didn't just happen by chance. Somebody intended that to happen, because everything that's going on, from the carpet to the music to the colors to the displays, that's what's creating the sentiments in our world today. And I say, well, maybe we're cutting out the chest, or maybe we're just disfiguring it. So Richard Weaver wrote in his book, Ideas Have Consequences, he wrote a chapter on the unsentimental sentiments. So when we think about sentiment, too often we think about emotions. Well, get that out of your head. That's not what we're talking about. Maybe we are really dealing with men whose chests have been informed by the ethos of the world. So our message is unfitting to the sentiments cultivated in the chest of the humanity by the West. That doesn't surprise us, or so it shouldn't, that young people aren't too enamored with Christianity. And what is amazing is the church, in trying to reach the youth, are doing the very same thing that the world is doing to the youth. And then we're wondering why they're not interested in hearing the message of the truth. The power of imagination. How many have read any, well, some of you have read Abolition of Man. How many have read any of Lewis other than The Abolition of Man? Okay, right. You don't really like that reading, do you? No, of course you do. Lewis is a master, isn't he? Lewis is a master of telling a story, of using imagination. And well, so we'll talk a little bit about imagination. Notice I've titled this Argumentation and Imagination. I'm not trying to deny the usefulness of argument. There's a place for it. I think there's a growing need for us to use imagination in our apologetics. For C.S. Lewis, imagination was only possible because of metaphysical realism, as imagination was only a rearranging of the real. Have you ever seen a monster created by some? Well, I've seen a few monsters in my life, but have you ever seen somebody who created, you know, a monster, and they're going to have a television show, and it's going to be a monster? Does the monster have pretty much the same apertures as, or appendages, excuse me, that we have? Now, they may have six eyes, but they have eyes. They may have straight legs, crooked legs, but they may have 10 of them, and we only have two, most of us. Lewis's point is, imagination deals with reality. It just takes the things of reality and works them a little bit different. That's what imagination does. So when Lewis has animals in Narnia, they talk, but they look like this, they look like an animal. He doesn't create something that's not already created. That's all the stuff we work out of. Lewis thought that human imagination is a truth-bearing faculty and an organ of meaning through which the desire can be awakened by various kinds of encounters with beauty. How do we awaken this? And then he says, the good things even of this world are far too good ever to be reached by imagination. He said, you know, he said, well, even the common orange, you know, no one ever could have imagined it before it tasted it. Think of something that doesn't exist in your world. Just try to do that. It's pretty difficult, isn't it? You put it together, but imagination can take those things and work with them out of the real world and use them, as Lewis did and as Tolkien did. in the Hobbit, the Lord of the Rings, etc. The present truth, then, we try to present covertly. Lewis would say, well, we use our imagination this way. What if, or what he called the supposal? Supposal, well, maybe suppose we look at it this way, or suppose we look at it that way. Would it look differently to us? How might we get a message through by doing it different? He said, but suppose that by casting it all into imaginary worlds, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. In other words, we come forth, Lewis is thinking, could we do it in a way, that is, present the gospel in a way that's creative and uses the imagination, that, as it were, people are getting the gospel before they even know what they're getting, so to speak. We seek to awaken the best in man because he's in God's image. I think this is a mistake of some Christian artist. They paint some of the things of ugliness. They say, well, I'm just painting that the way the world is. And I say, you don't have to paint ugliness. There's plenty of it around. What we need to do is to find a way to create works of art that touch the best in man. You say, there isn't any good in man. He's a totally depraved creature, and I will beg to differ with you, though I will agree that he is alienated from God. Yes, and I will agree with the fact that he is totally corrupt. Yes, I'll agree to all those things. But as Schaeffer said, he said, you may not like this, but man has nobility. He is a noble creature. Why? He's made in the image of God. And that's there. He said, I think that we've missed a great opportunity of evangelism because we didn't appeal to the nobility of man. Now, that's a strange thing to hear today, I suppose. But I think that Schaeffer was spot on with that. We take the truth and speak in terms that touches the chest to retrain the sensibilities. The intuition of reality has been distorted by the media in particular, I suggest, which makes the truth of reality very hard to communicate. Remember that sentiment is anterior to reason. Weaver says, we do not undertake to reason about anything until we've been drawn to it by an effective interest. That's our job. Create an effective interest in something other than what the sentiments have already been trained. Lewis thought you could do that. Imagination could help to reorder our loves. That would be an Augustinian view, ardo amoris, to order our loves. The head must be trained. The head must train proper sentiments. The head is the training for the sentiments. But today, the head is all bypassed. We're really kind of sentimental sentimist. And you listen to the arguments that people give. The head must train proper sentiments. But in our day, I say all we have are sentimental sentiments. But imagination works for objective truth, and it can speak to man, I think, in an effective way without compromising the gospel at all. I can show how this is done. How many have seen Million Dollar Baby? Anybody seen the movie Million Dollar Baby? All right. I say if I were teaching film class, every student would have to watch Million Dollar Baby. That is the most profound way of what I'm talking about. At the end of the film, you're almost thinking that, Clint Eastwood. You're almost thinking, yeah, he was right to take her life. And then you say, what the world am I thinking of? That's not Christian. But you see how that story was woven to retrain our sentiments, for maybe, yes, only for an hour. But it retrained our sentiments so that it actually changed our beliefs. Amazing that it can do that. Or 7 pounds. The whole issue of whether, what about, is sort of a secularistic resurrection. You get to live beyond yourself by giving your different body parts. Avatar. Why is there people who left the movie, the first movie, from Avatar, and they were depressed? Because the movie pulled them in through imagination and showed them what they really want inside their souls. But then they woke up and the lights come on and you go outside and say, oh no, the world is still there. It's not like I want it to be. It was tapping in to what humanity really desires. Or My Sister's Keeper, for those of you who have seen My Sister's Keeper. All these movies, with the exception probably of Avatar, these movies all deal with very deep sociological, cultural, and I would say philosophical issues. And they draw you in and reshape your sentiments to believe something that before you started watching the movie you didn't believe in. We use imagination to highlight truth and goodness in beauty. It brings forth a longing for the way things ought to be. There's a letter from that is written, and it's to Lewis, I think. And the letter was from a teacher who lived in New Jersey, and she was reading Lewis, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and she was reading it to third graders. She had come to the point where the lion Aslan allowed himself to be killed by his enemies to save a bad boy's life. Well, the attitude in the room, said that this teacher, was worship and holiness. Oh, Aslan. The rare impression of that moment will never leave me. Third graders, overwhelmed by imagination. And what did they think of? Somebody who would give his life for another. But somebody you had grown to love. Oh, you can't read the Chronicles of Narnia without loving Aslan, right? You remember the lady who wrote to Mr. Lewis, and she said, Mr. Lewis, I'm afraid my son loves Aslan more than he loves Christ. And Lewis wrote back to her and said, Dear Mrs. So-and-so, if your son loves Aslan, he will love Christ. Well, here we have this situation. Aslan is dead. And then a child who had read further said, Don't give up! Don't give up! Something wonderful is going to happen. And she said it crept through the room like the sighs. The little people had caught a glimpse of the very real, the very miracle of spiritual understanding. They were overwhelmed that one had given his life, and it looked like the end. And this little lad stood and said, No, 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 you don't have to worry. I have good news. I've read ahead. Well, isn't that the truth of our story? We've read ahead, haven't we? And we know that Christ was already raised from the grave, but that he's coming again. That's a message of hope. But it's also a great message of worship, is it not? That one would give himself for us. But notice how Lewis packages that. He didn't do it by rational argument and giving 6 reasons for the resurrection. Now, I'm not saying you might not want to do that sometime. Imagination is focused on truth, goodness, and beauty. We use it to highlight it. Oh, the world is tired of the lies. How many have seen Secondhand Lions? Oh my, it's an awful film from a philosophical, theological position. But in it, one lad says, he's asking in an adult, but what happened? What happened? And the adult says, well, it doesn't matter. And the little boy says, yes, it does. And the old man said, why does it matter? He says, because around my mother, all I hear are lies and lies. I don't know what the truth is anymore. So I need to know, did this really happen? And our culture is in that state of affairs. lie after lie after lie. What we need to do is to be able to reach in and touch the best in humanity with truth, goodness, and beauty. Why? Because that's what you and I were made for. We were made for the garden. We were not made for the grave. Remember that. This is what brings forth a longing for the way things ought to be. We were made for the garden and not the grave. Provoke a desire. Imagination is not about escapism. See, when I was growing up as a lad, I thought imagination was only a way to escape things. No, it's not an escapism. It's a way of rearranging things to make a great point. I mentioned, has anybody ever seen the movie A Terminal with Tom Hanks? Yeah. Well, it's imaginative. You don't have those sort of things, but they're real people. But it brings to light, highlight the importance of friendship. Why can't we do that for the gospel? Because I think we've not thought well about it. Francis Schaeffer says, perhaps you don't like the word. I've already spoken to that. He says, I want to add here that evangelicals have often made a serious mistake by equating the fact that man is lost and under God's judgment with the idea that man is nothing, that he is a zero. This is not, Schaeffer said, what the Bible says. There is something great about man, and we have lost perhaps our greatest opportunity of evangelism in our generation by not resisting, by not insisting that it is the Bible that explains why man is great. Yeah. We're so quick to want to be sure that we're true to the Bible, and we don't want to give man an inch to think he's good. Don't worry about that. Treat man with some noble. Now, how strong is this? Nietzsche. You all know something about Friedrich Nietzsche. God is dead. 6 months before Nietzsche goes out of public eye. Now, you know he was very sick. He was a brilliant man. He really was a brilliant man. But 6 months before he goes to live with his mother, and then his mom dies, and then he goes to live with his sister. But he writes a little book titled by Human, All Too Human. Now, this is what he says in this book. How strong the metaphysical need is, and how hard nature makes it to bid it farewell, can be seen by the fact that even when one free spirit, now free spirit was the word that was used of an atheist. They still use that term, the free spirit organizations all over the world. So he's talking about the atheist who tries to get rid of anything metaphysical, anything above the physical, has divested himself of everything of the metaphysical. Now notice this. The highest effects of an art can easily set the metaphysical strings which have long been silent or indeed snapped apart, vibrate in sympathy. He feels a profound stab in the heart and sighs for the man who will lead him back to his lost love, whether she be called religion or metaphysics. Nietzsche is saying, the beauty in a great piece of music. Of course, Nietzsche loved Wagner, but a great piece of music, a great work of art. Walking in to a great cathedral. Architecture is a very powerful mode of art. Our churches today, many at least in my country, point to nothing beyond themselves. Our architecture is pitiful. Our art is often pitiful. Why? Because artists want to be evangelistic. First, we must be faithful to Christ, truth, goodness, and beauty. If we create art like that, guess what? It will be evangelistic. Why is it that it attracts people? We have to retrain the sentiments, as Lewis would say. And one way that we can do that is through the arts. I don't think it's the only one.